This is community radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF, and now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard, here on KWTF.
Welcome to KWTF and a continuation of our Voices from Behind the Walls, a reading of the publication from Marshall Eddie Conway, prisoner at Jessup, Maryland. And reading today will be David Ingalls from Cop Watch and Patch, and Marty McReynolds from Santa Rosa, ACLU, and Patch.
This is David Engel. We are continuing Chapter 11, The Bowels of Hell. The most active prisoners in the penitentiary worked on these initiatives, and soon a crew developed that worked on nothing but the arrangements for the programs. Contacting people, setting up equipment, doing PR work, and processing the paperwork needed to get people into the prison. Before long, the programs had become a regular part of the prison's activities. Participants looked forward to the sessions on a monthly basis. The month of February was soon heralded throughout the prison system as a time to focus on Black History programs. We also developed a video program that taped the weekly events and played them back during the week for prisoners who failed to attend the originals, because of the limited number of people allowed in the areas at any time. Our first year of programming was so successful that we won the support of the educational department for the second year's programs. The teaching staff got involved, and many more community leaders traveled into the prison to interact with the population through lectures and debates, exchanging viewpoints and getting to understand the need for strong community prison involvement in order to really develop a sense of community with the local community leaders and activists. And the two groups were drawing closer together. In fact, you could see the impact of these programs by watching the effects they had on the general population. At first, the prisoners would stand around the yard as the outside guest came in, and for the most part, they viewed these people as part of the enemy, as were all members of society. They were viewed as someone to be preyed upon if given the opportunity. To many prisoners, everyone outside the immediate family and circle of friends was fair game in his efforts to gain the things he wanted out of life. So these outside strangers were not viewed as friends or even someone they wanted to get to know, except perhaps to prey upon them for material gains. No one had ever come to the prison in the past for any reason that was in the interest of the prisoners, without pay or some type of reward. These new people were coming in for no other reason than they shared a real concern for the well-being of the prisoners, but most of the men were just watching them for some sign of hostility. And as you might expect, most prisoners are very bitter about the level of isolation that they are placed in. They think that society sees them as the scum of the earth and doesn't want to be around them, so they, in turn, react the same way to people from the outside. They would come up to the programs and listen to the speaker very quietly. They would hear different people make commitments to return and do this or that the next time, and they wouldn't believe a word of it. But when those speakers came back and kept their word, it was a whole new experience for the prisoners to have someone make a commitment to them and follow up by keeping it. Once the speakers started to talk about the things that were affecting their community and the prison system together, and suggested that the prisoners and the outside community should work closer together and address these issues collectively, the feeling started to warm up between them. Many of the things we talked about were the things that no one had ever taken the time to talk to prisoners about. Things like the need to develop programs for newly freed prisoners, to give them time to get themselves oriented and economically situated before being forced to make choices that could affect their future. Things like 6 months' worth of unemployment benefits. Things like more community houses for outreach programs and stronger community interaction between the two groups. The hard part of this was the need for the prisoners to start working in the interest of the community to aid in the control of the rising crime rate. There were already programs being developed between the prisoners and the community along these lines. The 7-step turnaround program was one of them. Many youth from the surrounding community would come in to the prison to participate in the Scared Straight program, known simply as Project T. Members of the collective would talk to these youth about the real conditions of the prison and the relationships that new prisoners find themselves in. The sessions would be very serious, and all too many times the hard facts would be too much for some of the youth. The group would take a tour through the prison, mainly in the nicer areas, and during the process they would get locked in cells and left there for a period of time. The group would return to the program area and continue their interaction around what they'd seen and how they felt about it. The program seemed to help some of the youth, but it wasn't as effective as the 10-week counseling program established later that provided almost 3 months of group and individual interactions, allowing close relationships to develop between the youth and their counselors. We continue with Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. This is Chapter 12, Civil Awareness and Famous Amos. Project T was a one-off program that largely failed. It was aimed at youth of African descent who were already on the path to incarceration, but it seemed to have the most impact on the few white youth from middle-class neighborhoods who participated. It was quickly discontinued, but prisoners continued to look for ways they could serve the community and, in turn, receive the community's help and support. As more community people came into the prison, the network continued to grow and become strong. There was a pattern to these programs. During the first few months of any new initiative, only a small number of prisoners would participate, but then, before we knew it, more and more men would get involved. Eventually, as the programs and outside participants became popular, the prisoners would meet them in the yard and accompany them to the building where we were meeting, and back across the yard after the program. We were building community with the outside guests, as both guests and prisoners adopted each other, creating an extended family. This mutual acceptance led to the development of a series of civil awareness programs shortly afterward. During the 1982 elections, a number of issues became important to the black community, and because of that, some attention was created around them in the penitentiary. The first and most important question was, who were all these people running for office? What did they think and feel about prisoners at the penitentiary? The people who visited the prisoners found themselves talking more and more about the politics of the coming election. The prisoners, for their part, were seeking more information about the candidates. They were asking questions that, for the most part, their contacts outside could not answer. In fact, in all too many cases, it was the visitors who accepted and respected the prisoners' opinion about these things, looked at the prisoners as having worldly knowledge and insight into the world of politics. It became clear that the prisoners wanted to play a role in the city and state elections coming up that November. It didn't take long before a committee was formed to invite all the candidates to come and speak in the library to as many of the prisoners in the population as possible. Many of them accepted this offer, and it wasn't long before the first scheduled speakers arrived and the civil awareness program was off to a rousing start. The interest and concern around some candidates grew to the point where election committees made posters to inform the population about their candidates' positions and the reasons a prisoner should support them. Leaflets were passed around that could be sent home to families or friends at the next letter-writing time. There was an equal amount of campaigning against the candidates that had taken strong anti-prisoner or negative positions on issues that affected the community in the long run. Some committees went as far as making videos for their candidates and showing them in the library periodically to groups of prisoners who shared an interest in the candidate after reading the literature or talking to supporters. The amount of activity continued to grow right up to the day of the election. The high point of the whole program was the day that Billy Murphy, the mayoral candidate for Baltimore, came to speak and to answer questions in the prison. No one had ever given us that type of respect before, and all the prison's officials wanted to attend the program. And although no one believed he could win that year, the hope for having a black mayor in Baltimore was very high, and of great importance to the black population all over the city. In the prison, we felt it was a step in the right direction, and one that we needed if there was ever any hope of correcting some of the problems that kept the black community in its current sad state. We wanted to develop other images of black men for our communities and for the world, besides the gangster and the criminal that pervaded society at large. There were a good number of us involved in the happenings of the community and concerned about the future of our youth. The level of awareness was at an all-time high in the prison, but so was the growing level of apathy in the community and in the prison. This was the era of Ronald Reagan, and the feeling that things were just getting worse in the black community was supported by hundreds of declining statistics on the well-being and welfare of minorities in the U.S. The truth was that the party of the working class was fluctuating wildly in its position on the black community's needs and issues. It was all too clear that the Democratic Party was moving far to the right in the hopes of keeping some of its southern supporters and garnering support from whites in major urban areas. We dreamed of a new political arrangement, a black popular political party. This would not be the first of its kind, but it would be the first one in the second half of the 20th century. The political elements in the prison population thought that this would be a positive move forward for black people in general. We wanted to be a part of this developing movement. The National Black Independence Political Party, or NBIPP, was forming in black communities across the country, though it was largely concentrated in major urban areas in the north. We decided to form a chapter in the prison after a number of meetings designed to show the general population the need for such a party among the black prisoners. We invited some of the local party leaders, many of whom we had met during the civic involvement campaign, to come and speak to the population. Although the election was ultimately a failure for the black candidates, it was a progressive development for the prison. The candidates we met were impressed by the level of interest in the prison and asked some of the national leadership to come and speak with us. Both political and apolitical brothers wanted to get involved in the struggle of the black community. We held a number of meetings after the candidates and other party leaders had come and gone and decided that we would form a chapter and request official recognition. We would work closely with the Baltimore chapter, and we asked a number of our outside supporters to join in with the local chapter to ensure that it would be more positive and supportive towards prisoners and prison issues. The NBIPP national headquarters were located in Washington, D.C., so we also made contact with the national branch of the party. We started gathering members and organizing meetings and agendas, but there was very real concern at this point about our official recognition and our acceptance in the prison as a legal organization. There were some people still thinking about the massive attacks we had faced when we formed the labor union, and there was a strong contingent of brothers who felt that we needed to be first recognized as a political organization before any real political work was started. Others among us felt that we should move ahead without official approval. We had reached a stalemate. We had two factions that each supported what they thought was the best course of action. The administration never did give us official approval. It is a rule that no institution will sanction its own real opposition in a power struggle for the hearts and minds of the people with whom it interacts. The chapter simply faded away after some internal struggle over the delays because it lacked the willpower and drive to carry out its programs and policies without the oppressor's authorization. Everybody had been saying that the literacy rate in the U.S. was lower than it had to be. The Enoch Pratt Public Libraries in Baltimore were trying to do something about that in our city, and literacy programs were springing up all across America as people tried to help more people gain control over their lives. The trend soon reached the brothers in the penitentiary. No one could believe the number of prisoners who could not read or write. The truth was that the illiterate prisoner would employ a number of disguises to fool the unaware. Some of the disguises were almost a science. Take the case of the prisoner who would read the newspaper every day. This brother would listen to the news every night and then all day long would talk about things in the news as if he read them in the newspaper he carried around with him on full display. People never gave it any thought because you just don't question these things unless they are pointed out to you. This brother fooled everyone for a number of years before it was discovered that he really could not read at all. Everyone was so shocked that people would keep testing him to see for themselves that this were true. Members of the collective knew that a large percentage of the prison population was illiterate. It was no real surprise to anyone. What was surprising was the number of people that were willing to give up their time to aid others in learning to read and write. Our literacy program developed a bit unexpectedly. At one of our other events, we had invited someone from the Central Library to come and speak, and she had brought along a co-worker who was active in the library's literacy work. As always, during our programs, we encouraged everyone to speak out, and the conversation became heated that day, as one of the prisoners began to list all the things that were wrong in the prisons, including the fact that so many prisoners couldn't even read. And then this prisoner turned to the library worker and yelled at her, asking what she was going to do about it. Well, she said that she would come back and set up a program that would help prisoners learn to read, and in turn, she yelled back at the prisoner, "Now what are you going to do?" The die was cast, and afterwards, we thought we would have at least one meeting to see if anyone was really interested. The meeting took place about a month later, and a fairly large number of prisoners attended. We set up additional meetings at which we screened films and discussed the finer points of just what would be needed to set up such a program. The screenings and meetings turned into a training program with people from the Pratt Libraries, and eventually they produced a number of prisoners who were ready to start a literacy program in Baltimore and other cities. Famous Amos, the cookie maker, was supporting the development of literacy programs around the country. We got in contact with him, and he agreed to appear at our opening program with some of his famous cookies. The opening event proved to be very important to the future of the program itself. Famous Amos came and brought the cookies, and the population turned out in full force. He talked to the brothers about making the millions that they always dreamed of making, and told them how important it is to know how to read and write just to handle any amount of money. The one thing about many prisoners, and perhaps this is true of people in general, is that they tend to listen to the millionaires of the world. The program became an overnight success because of Famous Amos. It's true that we had to do the real work on a day-to-day basis to keep the program functioning, but I am sure that we would not have gotten started so well if we hadn't gotten a little help from our friends. Everyone working with the program was motivated to get a friend involved, the readers and non-readers alike. Our sessions were structured in such a manner that a buddy could sit in the program with the non-reader and give him support and even aid if he wanted to, by going over assignments back in the housing area. This program helped an untold number of prisoners, and it eventually became so successful that it eventually developed into its own unofficial GED program.
This is Marty McReynolds reading Chapter 13, The House. Life in the penitentiary was rapidly draining my energy. I spent much of my time just trying to navigate regular daily activities. By this time, a number of old comrades had been released and were back out in the community. The feedback that I was getting wasn't good. Some of the problems that the brothers faced once they were freed were so overwhelming that they were unable to do any serious community organizing. There were other factors also, like the daily struggle for survival, the move away from leftist politics in the 1980s, and the abrupt nationwide swing to the right. These factors made it seem like these brothers were not going to be of any use to the community at large. The times were bad for me as well, because I was confronted with the fact that I, like so many others, had made sacrifices and participated in struggles that now seemed for naught. I had begun to wonder what it had all been for, especially since these comrades seemed unwilling or unable to struggle to make our community better. I spent a lot of time soul-searching and talking to people from the community about these comrades and their actions or lack thereof. These were people who had been organizing in the neighborhoods for the past dozen years or so, and were still continuing to work and struggle. I wondered how these sisters and brothers could continue their efforts year after year, yet the comrades who were just coming out of prison seemed to run out of energy within the first 2 years. The problem seemed to be that community-based organizers were established in the area and had credibility with other community institutions and individuals. The just released prisoner was not accepted by the community as a positive role model based on his or her political beliefs. In all too many cases, their economic situation was shaky at best. These returning comrades found themselves supporting a lot of beliefs that the community did not agree with or even understand at this point. The lack of an infrastructure to accept these returnees added to the problems that they faced. Needless to say, at the time all I could see was that a number of ex-prisoners who claimed to have serious political convictions were not dealing with the struggle in the ways that we, from the inside, thought it should be dealt with. Who could we depend upon if our comrades were not able to return to the community and be committed to working for the brothers and sisters in prison as well as in the community? These things seemed even more depressing when we continually heard that this or that ex-comrade had done this or that to negatively impact the community. I became wary of prisoners who, for the most part, seemed to lose all consciousness upon release from prison. It seemed to me that they had been hiding behind the cover of prison oppression to do their time, and once their bit was up, they no longer thought the problems existed, and simply spent their time partying and trying to forget the hard times we had experienced together over the years. Our comrades were not the only prisoners who spent hard times in the prison system with organized groups and then returned to society to forget the struggle and their comrades left behind inside. Almost every group was experiencing the same problem, and there was a lot of discussion on the causes of this new development. The thing that we could not understand was how these brothers could spend years being beaten and oppressed along with the rest of us and then forget all about it once they were released. The programs and support from the community continued to come from the same elements in the black community and progressive elements of the white community, but didn't grow to encompass the newly released men. I was nearing a point in my time when I could not put up with a lot of bullshit from people. I wanted to get out of the penitentiary for a number of reasons. This was my 13th year in the prison system, and all my friends were going to other prisons or going home. The system itself was overcrowded, and I had just finished 4 years of college. I had done everything humanly possible in the penitentiary, and the turnover of the population would require another few years to raise the level of political consciousness to what it had been a few years before all the transfers and the general mood in the U.S. had shifted. I, for one, was not trying to spend any more time working in a setting where I felt my efforts were a waste of time and energy. The classification department claimed that they had been instructed to get a number of prisoners out of the Maryland penitentiary and into other institutions. So I decided that this was an ideal time for me to make my move. In more than a decade in the prison system, I had only been in the classification department a handful of times. The system never worked for the prisoners, and we basically understood it to be something the officials used to cover their asses with the public and with the budget managers who controlled or questioned where the funds for prisoners' rehabilitation went. The classification system was held up as the tool that reviewed and oversaw all the improvements, or lack of improvements, in each prisoner's situation. This system rarely, if ever, gave the prisoner a fair shake. And most people knew that it was pointless to go before these people if you had made enemies within the penitentiary's administration. I surely had more than enough enemies to go around. The fact that the classification department didn't work in the average non-political case made it that much more unlikely that I would be given any real consideration. After all, I had a lot of time ahead of me, and the nature of my case was still very political and very public. The enemies that I had made some years before were now top administration officials, and many of them had made it clear that they held grudges from past conflicts. In fact, there were some who refused to speak to me, and who only spoke to me through a third party, and I responded to their behavior in kind. In order to get official approval for a transfer, each prisoner had to be deemed a non-security risk. Of course, the staff would not mention their personal grudges, but the bias could have an impact on your case if you were in front of one of the old clique members. The only chance that I might have would be if I could get scheduled to go before the classification team while a black official was sitting on the team, or at least a non-clique white official. Since the classification officials were working to get a number of prisoners out of the penitentiary as a result of a lawsuit that had been filed about the overcrowding and general living conditions at the prison and throughout the system, I thought the time was ripe. They were processing transfers largely because the staff had been scheduling prisoners to go before officials who would easily approve of the transfer to other institutions. I made a request to be scheduled for such a review. The classification process takes only a few minutes at best. The prisoner is called into a room for an interview with three panel members. Each prisoner's file has been read and discussed before this meeting, and it is likely that the decision has been made in most cases before the prisoner appears in front of them. The interview becomes little more than a verbal stamp of approval, and the decision is almost always supported by the administration officials once it has been made. The key was to get a positive decision from the panel before the interview was conducted. That could be done in a number of ways. One of the panel members would be the prisoner's classification counselor. Another was likely to be a state employee who worked within the prison compound. And finally, there would be a guard officer. So, you would find the time when the best possible officer is scheduled for the team. And you would know that along with your classification counselor, there would be two possible votes in your favor. The state employee almost always goes with the decision of the other two persons unless there is a personal reason to oppose. I was before the team and out of the hearing room in less than 13 minutes. They had decided to let me go to another prison with lesser security. The papers had to go before the warden for his approval, but that was a process that would take only a few days in most cases. After the warden, the paperwork would be reviewed by the commissioner's office at the state headquarters for the Department of Corrections. Once reviewed and approved by the Department of Corrections, your papers come back and you are assigned a new prison to be transferred to. In my case, it was the Maryland House of Correction in the Jessup, Maryland prison complex, better known as the Cut. Once assigned to a new prison facility, you wait. The waiting is almost as hard as the classifying part itself. Week after week drags by, and the pressure builds as group after group leaves and you wait for your turn to come. In my case, the situation was a little worse, since I still had enemies in high places in the administration. They realized that I had gotten around them by planning the transfer and having it followed up on the commissioner level. They did not want to let me out of their control, but they were powerless to stop me at that point without some direct involvement. So the major who controlled the list of who was transferring called me in his office one morning and asked me if I was ready to go and informed me that I would be on the next trip out on the following Tuesday. It was odd, to say the least, because this major had not spoken to me in a number of years, since 1976, and we both knew that we did not like each other, and everyone around us knew it. Well, as it turned out, I didn't leave that next Tuesday, or the next Tuesday after that. The wait grew into a month, and then another month. I was uptight, because I knew these people were really trying to screw with me and get me to blow the transfer. Finally, the day came when I was informed that I'd be leaving and to bring all my property down to the central storeroom. I was at the point where I did not believe I was going to get out of that place until I actually left it behind me. It took hours just to go through all the things that I had gathered over all the years in the pen. I left over half the stuff there, and was glad when the rest was finally packed up and boxes sealed to be transferred out to the bus that would be taking us to the cut. They kept us locked in the storeroom for half the day. All day long, brothers were coming by to bid us farewell and to hope that we would never return to this place again under the same conditions. And suddenly, the bus arrived, and it was time to go. It was a cold, dull, rainy day in late November 1983, right after Thanksgiving. The mood was perfect. I have always loved the rain, and this day it would seem more meaningful than ever, because I found myself standing in the yard of the penitentiary for the last time. The place was full of memories from the last 13 years of my life. Just feet away, down in the central part of the upper yard, many major events had taken place that would shape the lives and history of prisoners and the prison struggle in general. There was a fence between me and the bus. The gate opened, and we packed our things on the vehicle and prepared to leave. Now all that remained was to drive out the back gate and into the street behind the prison. One last look at the prison brought something home to me. The yards were empty. Five of us were seated on that 70-seat bus, and after all these years, I was rolling through the back gate. I thought I would feel happiness, but all I felt was the need to never come back this way again. I don't ever want to see the penitentiary again as a prisoner. Moving to the cut was like traveling back in time. While I did my time in the Maryland Penitentiary, I had watched many prisoners get transferred to Jessup. The word among the prison population was that a transfer to the cut was the best way to get into the work release program, the first step toward a return to the community if one could make parole. So I was shocked when I entered the yard at Jessup for the first time and found that many prisoners I thought had long since gone home were still there. It was like we had suddenly gone back 5 years and were huddled around the yard at the penitentiary. Needless to say, my bubble burst, and things went even further downhill from there. The Maryland House of Corrections had been built to hold 750 prisoners. Imprisoned within this structure were 2,200 men. The prison was nearly a century old and had actually been condemned several times in the last 20 years. Yet it was bursting with black bodies stacked one on top of the other. In order to get to breakfast by 8 or 9 in the morning, we had to rise at 4 in the morning. The inhumane conditions at the prison angered me to no end, and as my organizing gene began to kick in, I found myself engaged in a class action lawsuit against the cut. old habits are so hard to break. Some of us helped to organize a committee of prisoners who had access to all areas of the prison. We were soon reporting the various code violations to a legal team composed of lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and the National Prison Project. The violations and complaints ranged from overcrowded conditions to the secret areas of the prison that were used to isolate and beat prisoners, to sanitary issues. I know that many people are familiar with the overly romanticized story of the Birdman of Alcatraz. But we had birds, and there was very little appreciation for them. They flew overhead as if we were outside. After 5 years of struggle and many threats to the men who were involved, we won the case. The population was reduced to 1,300. The hidden areas were closed down, and it soon became safe to walk through the prison without the birds crapping on us. Overall, the climate changed as the food and medical care issues were corrected and recreation time became ample. In fact, the cut improved so much that soon most of the prisoners in the state prison population were trying to get transferred to this facility. But not long after the changes were implemented, the gangsters began to gain control of the prison. They were in frequent conflict with the progressive elements, who were actively involving much of the prison population in efforts to develop closer community and family ties. This would be an ongoing struggle for several years, us trying to educate and organize, and the gangsters trying to gain power and capitalize through the drug trade. I had begun to get involved in the implementation of programs once again, which included teaching basic computer skills to men in the population, as well as organizing cultural programs. While I was at the penitentiary, I had earned a bachelor's degree from Coppin State University, and in 2001, I began work on my master's degree. This final educational goal has been a challenge, and in some circles, I have jokingly become known as the oldest living graduate student. Throughout my imprisonment, I have been fortunate to be able to meet and work with a variety of people from around the U.S., and a few from around the world as well. While I was still in the penitentiary, Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, then known as H. Rap Brown, was held briefly during the early 1970s, and the collective organized support during his stay. Sometime after his release in the mid-80s, he returned to visit and speak with many of us from the population about his new worldview of Islam and the revolution. A number of religious leaders have taken the time to visit and provide their support. Activist preacher Kwame Abojamy has long been a friend, and the Reverend Grayland Hagler took the time to come speak to the prison population during one of our Martin Luther King birthday celebrations in 2005. Reverend Frank Reed of Bethel AME Church in Baltimore visited me in 2001, and we shared our respective views about the church's role in rebuilding Baltimore, as well as how he might provide support for my case. On the cultural front, Haki Madhubuti, the noted author and founder of Third World Press, came to the penitentiary at the invitation of the collective. He spoke about the conditions confronting African Americans in the 1980s. Later, at the Maryland House of Corrections, I participated in a project called the Malcolm X Book Club, and we hosted a number of people, including the actors Avery Brooks and Andre Braugher, who discussed the movie Glory, and also presented examples of their theater work to the population. The book club also hosted Asa Gordon, the first African-American to work at NASA as a rocket scientist, and writer and historian Asa Hilliard, who gave a lecture entitled Africa's Early Civilizations, which garnered a lot of participation from the population. Before the closure of the Maryland House of Corrections in 2006, I organized a dialogue with Salvadoran peace activist Marta Benavides. She came in and worked with a veterans group that I was part of. But what made this session unique was the fact that the men in the veterans group, who were all African descended, brought in Latino prisoners from their housing units. Maryland does not have a large Latino population in its prisons yet, but this was an attempt at solidarity with these men. Unfortunately, when the prisoners from the House of Corrections were moved throughout the system, we were unable to build on this effort. I have also received encouragement and support from actors Charles Dutton and Ruby Dee and the late Ossie Davis, who proved to be quiet yet stalwart supporters. Over the years, I have also received visits from many former BPP comrades. Kathleen Cleaver visited when she came to Baltimore to speak at a fundraiser on my behalf, and we had an interesting dialogue on the issues facing African Americans in the 21st century. Bob Brown came through after playing a key role as an organizer of the Million Man March. Bob had also been one of the founding members of the Chicago chapter of the BPP. Malik Rahim, a BPP member from New Orleans, visited to thank the prisoners for their support after Hurricane Katrina. And former Baltimore Panther Paul Coates has been a key supporter and friend for the past 40 years. Also memorable, if only because of the spectacle they created, was a visit from David Hilliard and Elaine Brown, both former members of the Central Committee of the BPP. This occurred shortly after the Mario Van Peebles film Panther was released. In fact, it was like something out of a Hollywood movie, because even the guards talked about this pair. They claimed that the two had arrived in a limousine and that Brown was wearing a fur coat. David, Elaine, and I talked about aid and support for the freedom of political prisoners, but this meeting of the minds would bear no fruit. The phone number that Hilliard left me turned out to be a bordello somewhere in Texas. I haven't heard from them since. For as long as I can remember, someone has always been saying, "You need to meet this person." This statement was soon followed by the declaration that this individual was really serious about our struggle. In my 20s, I would dash off full of energy, hoping that I would find a new comrade, friend, or supporter who was also looking to make the world a better place. Well, by the 1980s, that dash had become a slow and deliberate walk, full of cautious regard for the person I was about to meet, merely hoping that they would at least be positive. When I first met Terrence Johnson, I was in my 40s and had 2 decades behind me as an angry black man. I am sure that all of this colored my first impression of him. However, I am still pretty certain that my image of Terrence Johnson was not far off the mark. But even today, knowing the outcome of his life, I am still conflicted. He had arrived at the Maryland House of Corrections by way of one of the prisons in Hagerstown. Nearly 15 years earlier, in 1978, Johnson, then a skinny 14-year-old kid, and his brother had been arrested by the Prince George's County Police. This police force had always had some notoriety among people of African descent, because simple traffic stops have resulted in harassment and the occasional lifeless black body on the side of the road. There is no such thing as a routine traffic stop for most people of African descent, because of the prevalence of abuse and brutality that so many have experienced at the hands of the police. Therefore, flashing lights in the mirror very often strike a nerve. Johnson would later state that he was brutally beaten by officers while in custody. Sometime during that beating, he managed to get hold of one officer's gun and fired. When the smoke cleared, 2 officers were dead, and Johnson was in a state of shock. I, like many other prisoners, took an interest in the campaign that resulted from his case. The case would eventually garner national attention, and I was given hope by the number of activists who were involving themselves in the campaign. The state of Maryland would ultimately be unsuccessful in an attempt to convict this young man on first-degree murder charges. Johnson would eventually be sentenced to 25 years as a result of a manslaughter conviction, and he would serve more time than anyone else in the state for such a charge. Many of the activists who were involved in his campaign were people with whom I was acquainted and had worked with in the past. This also made me hopeful that Johnson himself would develop into a politically active and conscious individual. Upon introduction, I had reached my hand out to Johnson and looked him over through a lens that was shaded with 25 years of struggle behind it. I was not happy at what I thought I saw. Johnson came across as arrogant and slick. I had the impression that he was full of himself, but I did understand how this experience could create that behavior in an otherwise innocent young man who had been wrongfully placed in prison. We talked for several minutes and agreed to meet again the following week. I soon found myself asking around about him, his Hagerstown time, and his friends. There are few secrets in prison. Someone is always around who knows someone from one of the other prisons. There would be information to be had, everything from the crew an individual hung with to how that individual walked, alone, mobbed up, straight, sneaky, or dirty. I was getting mixed feedback on Johnson. On one hand, many people did not care for him because of his apparent conceitedness. But on the other hand, everyone knew his story and felt sorry for him. Terrence Johnson had received a really bad deal at a young age, and he was coping with it in perhaps the best way possible for him at the time. The crowd he swung with was into drugs, and though I never saw any evidence of drug use on his part, I did not like the people he surrounded himself with. They were not just into the drugs, but most of them had reps as petty thieves, or they were of the 5 and 10 cent hustler sort. These are the type of individuals who are always trying to get that next shot of dope. I soon found myself faced with a dilemma. There were a lot of very good people on the outside who were working to win Johnson's release. The campaign, while not extremely successful, was widespread and energetic. Many people of African descent in Maryland and beyond felt that his situation was a grave injustice, and it was. Yet I sometimes wondered if they knew about Johnson's behavior behind the walls, and if it even mattered. I pondered whether I should say something, and I considered whether the information would cause people to end their support of him. Did I owe the comrades and supporters who were working on his behalf an accounting of his behavior and experience in prison? Or was correcting the injustice more important than his life behind bars? I remained quiet because I couldn't shake the belief that what he was doing and the things that he had involved himself in were all a reaction to the hell he'd caught behind his case. Prison is no place to be at any stage of life, but it is an especially cruel environment to come of age in. At the same time, to be a political symbol of sorts is especially burdensome for someone who, aside from understanding the injustice of his own situation, lacked a serious political orientation. To me, the situation had always been bigger than Johnson. Historically, it was the experience of all oppressed people since first contact. His case also represented a small snapshot of my own experience. The Fraternal Order of Police worked overtime to keep Johnson in prison and under the worst possible conditions, and he had been denied parole 4 times. I wanted him out because we needed a win against those oppressive forces that were abusing the youth in our community. In my thinking, the work being put in on his case was tantamount to resistance, and if this injustice was not corrected, it would continue to happen again and again. I remained hopeful that Johnson would have a chance to redirect his life once released from prison. Sadly, in the back of my head, I knew all too well that the things a prisoner does inside are generally the same things that she or he will do outside. Habits are hard to break, and it can be difficult to exorcise the demons of imprisonment once released. But I knew that Johnson deserved a chance to try to make a life beyond the walls. After 17 years in hell, Terrence Johnson returned to the community, and there was talk of great things, a book or movie, and Howard University School of Law. The book and movie deals never materialized, and instead of Howard, it was the University of the District of Columbia, and soon it was reality. It was not enough to be a man returning from prison after so many years with all the usual problems waiting on him. At every turn, Terrence Johnson was regarded as the cold-blooded cop killer. It also seems as if those folks who had supported Terrence Johnson, the political prisoner, did not bother to politicize him after his release. While incarcerated, he had pursued his education, and my impression was that he was really quite intelligent. However, Terrence Johnson left prison a man imprisoned as a child, and for all the support that he received, I cannot help but wonder if anyone considered this upon his release. It has been reported that, on his 34th birthday, Terrence Johnson made a failed attempt to rob a bank in Harford County, Maryland, and when cornered by the police, Johnson supposedly killed himself. However, I believe that Terrence died a slow death that began when the state placed him in an adult prison and kept him there until they could no longer justify it.
You have been listening to Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard, featured every week here on KWTF. Also reading today, Marty McReynolds and David Engels. Thanks for listening to this edition of Voices from Behind the Walls. We'll see you next week here on KWTF.
What's that music? Challenge the strong. The storm is coming, it grows on the waves. From Johannesburg to Montego Bay, what's that music? It's playing on the radio. What's that music? We resist in the present for those yet unborn. A freedom is spreading its wing like a bird, and the message it carries has got to be heard. Oh, what's that music? Ooh, I'm playing everywhere I go.
challenge the strong. The storm is coming, it grows on the waves. But from Johannesburg to Montego Bay, what's that music?
You know you need it.